Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Cinematic Universe, the podcast that used to be about comic book movies and now is just about whatever takes our damn fancy. So I am the host this week. My name is Rich Williamson. Joining me, as always, are...
James Hunt.
And Joe Cunningham.
And for those listeners who need reminding, as we do, as the hosts of what the new format is that each episode we rotate the host chair and the host picks a movie for all three to watch. And this episode, it has come to the first time around for the new format for me. I'm the host. That's why I'm talking. And of course, obviously, these two guys in the last 2 weeks, two episodes picked, you know, recent releases. I think the first thing we did was Poor Things, which had come out days before that episode recorded, days before. And then James picked Shortcomings, which came out last year. And so I, of course, obviously, followed that up by picking the 1981 Warren Beatty film Reds. That is 3 hours and 20 minutes long. Don't think I realized that when I picked it. I will say that. And listeners, if you're wondering, why Reds? Why now? Is he making a political statement? Is that a Blu-ray that he had at the top of his desk? Why? And then the answer is really just because it was on my Letterboxd watch list and I knew that James and Joe hadn't seen it. So that's all. That's the reason. And we will get to talk about Warren Beatty's 1981 film Reds in a short minute. But
we were reminiscing off mic, weren't we, that the first time we had you on the podcast as a guest way back when, what, like 7 or 8 years ago, we were like, Reese, what do you want to cover? And you were like, oh, Chronicle, super excited to cover Chronicle. That would be, yeah, that's my pick. That's great. And then you revealed to us as you turned up for the episode. Yeah, no, I'd not seen it before. I didn't know anything about it and kind of didn't like it. So this of course, going to be interesting, guys.
Well, at least the part where I hadn't seen it before has been true to form, and we will find out what we all thought about Reds a little later. But yes, I guess I'm just, I like the spontaneity of just picking something.
The spontaneity of 3.5 hour movies.
Yeah. Yeah, it was long. It really was very long. In fact, it was so long, I only just managed to finish it literally 3 minutes before we started recording. I finished it while eating dinner, coming back from Dune 2 before we started recording. So yes. That'll be Reds.
Not unlike you, Reese, to bring a bit of chaos to proceedings.
Indeed. But before we do that, we have got two little segments that we do before that. So we're going to go around the horn and talk about what we've been watching between episodes, anything we want to bring up. And then we'll talk about a news story that I have brought to the table that I haven't shared with these two guys. But we will discuss a news story that's interested me in the interim period. But first up, James, what have you been watching these last couple of weeks?
What have I been watching? I have watched a couple of documentaries recently, which I thought would be interesting to note. So I watched Scala, which is a documentary about the Scala Cinema in King's Cross, which was a kind of legendary UK grindhouse-type cinema during the 80s and 90s, and is now closed. Well, actually, it's not closed. The venue still exists, but it's no longer a cinema. So I watched that.
Didn't talk about this last time,
I was going to say, James, I'm pretty sure you mentioned that last time.
Are you sure?
I think we were just talking about it. Okay.
If we both, okay, fine. We can check the tape.
I only watched it on the 24th of February, according to Letterboxd, so.
Okay.
We have not discussed it specifically.
No, okay.
I maybe said I was going to. Anyway, I watched it. It was fine. You know, it's got some good talking heads. It's got like Adam Books and Stuart Lee and, you know, people like that. But it wasn't very deep, you know, it was a kind of a nostalgia piece. So I thought, okay, I'm going to watch a similar documentary, which was Meet Me in the Bathroom, which is another documentary based on a book about the New York garage punk scene of the early noughties. And it covers the Strokes and the AAS. And I thought, this will be good for me because I remember all that stuff and I'd like to see behind the scenes of it. And it sort of didn't do that. Again, it was just a kind of nostalgia piece where they were like, oh, do you remember the Yeah, yeah, here's what they did. And I was like, yeah, okay. So it's a pair of fine but not particularly impressive documentaries.
Which one was worse?
Which one was worse? Meet me in the bathroom, because towards the end they get to the bit where like they've had these massive debut albums or these like garage punk bands, and then the scene sort of starts to disintegrate and dissipate. And they don't really go into what the pressure of that was and why it stopped. And it sort of ends on a triumphant, like, now, you know, these guys won. And you're like, won what? You know, there was infighting and, you know, the second and third albums weren't as good as the first, whatever. It was just nothing, no insight, nothing that really excited me. And then to clear my palate, I watched Fear City, which is an Abel Ferrara film.
I think I saw you logging that Letterboxd. How the premise sounded cool. It was like a boxer teams up with a detective to investigate the killing of showgirls. Is that right?
Yeah. And Billy D. Williams is a homicide cop who just spouts the most awful racial slurs at everyone. It's you wouldn't get that sort of film now. I'll say that much. But, you know, it was fun. Again, it was more like, it was the kind of movie that they talked about in Scala. Like,
What led you to Fear City? You know, why did you watch that?
It was the shittiest looking thing on the BFI player. I was like, this looks like trash, it must be good. And also, I love Abel Ferrara for that reason.
Was it on the BFI player? Cause I know they've been doing a Scala season when the doc came out. Was it linked to that?
I wonder if that was why, yeah. Mm. I couldn't tell from the listing, but I suspect that's why it was there. Yeah.
I do love that sometimes where you'd be browsing the BFI player or Mubi or something like that, and you're like, yeah, should make the most of being subscribed to this right now. Oh, look, there's one of those movies that's listed in the top 20 movies of all time in the Sight of Sound list. And that film won the Palme d'Or. And that one's, yeah. What's the crappiest thing on here right now that I can kind of... I mean, it has to be in the English language. Definitely has to be in the English language because I'm too tired to read subtitles right now. Is there anything that looks kind of trashy but, you know, respectable enough that it's made it onto this platform? Yeah, great, okay.
I tell you, the best thing about Fear City is that it's the uncut version. And the way that manifests itself is a bunch of scenes are from a different transfer. So you'll be watching like a fully Blu-ray HD movie, and then mid-scene, mid-shot even, it will switch to a grainy, off-colour, transferred from VHS thing because some guy has got some nunchucks. It's very, very funny. If you've got the BFI player, I would recommend it.
And what, the nunchuck scene, it will be the blurry scene because the original UK cut would have that sliced out of it.
Yeah, right. You can't show nunchucks, right? Well, the most dangerous weapon, everyone knows that.
You couldn't call them the Ninja Turtles. They had to be the Hero Turtles. Sometimes it's nice to go back to our roots as a podcast, you know, thrown a little reference here and there. So then we haven't forgotten who we are.
Except we might be about to record an episode of Matt and Webb in about an hour, and then we will remember where we've come from, and we won't like that place at all. Be a bad place. James, is that everything?
Just to follow up last week, you recommended Mr. and Mrs. Smith. I have watched all the episodes since then. Me and my girlfriend, we thought it was fantastic.
Humble brag.
Slick. I have a girlfriend. I do. I thought it was slick, exciting, well written, well acted. I was gripped. I can't wait for them to do more. And in fact, if they don't do more, I'll be happy because it was perfect.
How does it? I actually haven't finished it yet. How does the season end? Does it resolve in a satisfactory way?
I wouldn't say it's a full cliffhanger, but it doesn't like tie things up and like, you know, end of the story. But, you know, it's a kind of finale where by the end you're like, you know, the lore of this isn't what I care about. It's the characters and their circumstances that you're going for.
Yeah.
And there's a really good episode with what's his face? Original Hellboy.
Ron Perlman.
Oh yes.
Ron Perlman. Yeah. Great episode with Ron Perlman in.
Yeah, I watched 5 of it's 8 episodes, right?
Yeah.
I think I watched 5, so I've seen most of them. And they were all just what I found, just what kept me pressing play until obviously I didn't press play for episode 6 2 weeks, was that they each episode felt really different to each other, whether it's the guest star or the setting, or you know, and they felt quite episodic, like the characters are going on a set emotional journey usually within the episode. And I found that all really refreshing and yeah. So now Joe, the baton moves to you a bit. You know, that's now 2 for 2. I've seen most of Mr. and Mrs. Smith. 2 out of 3. So you're up next. And it's a good. It's going to be very gendered and passive aggressive. So I'm not going to make that comment. Do you think it's a good Joe and Laura show to watch, James?
I mean, I don't know Laura that well, but. All I can say is me and Anna were both very invested. It's not like a standard dude show, you know. There's a lot of agency and, you know, a lot of character for the women in the show too. And what's her face is in it? God, I'm so bad with acting names. No, the character who did I May Destroy You?
Michaela Cole?
Michaela Cole is in it.
Is she in it?
In an episode, yeah. In a great role. Oh, just one episode, but really good.
Yeah, fine. Good. Okay. Is that all for you, James?
That's all for me.
Lovely stuff. Joe, what about you?
Oh, right. I'm looking at my Letterboxd. Been catching up on some Oscar movies. So I've watched Maestro and Past Lives and American Fiction.
What do you think of Fiction? I think
it's good. I messaged you guys afterwards. It's got a lot of parallels with Shortcomings, and I think it's more successful in tackling some of the themes of Shortcomings around you know, kind of representation of a previously underrepresented minority, and also has like a very misanthropic protagonist. But Jeffrey Wright is a very good actor. He deserves his Oscar nom, and you know that's one that's it's been coming. So yeah, he's great. The hook itself is funny. I think it's a little bit too cartoonish, I think, in the way that it deals with, you know, kind of the way the white world and the Hollywood world reacts to black stories. And I think that maybe it reminded me a little bit of Promising Young Woman in that respect, that, you know, it's like, here's this like quite potentially tough subject matter, and it just feels like it's been handled a little bit too kind of it's just been a bit too broadly sketched, and I actually think that it might have benefited from, like, you know, the real world reactions and the real world kind of, you know, the kind of projects that get greenlit, etc. You could have probably done it in a less cartoonish way. But yeah, Jeffrey Wright's really good. I mean, like, the central idea is funny, and like the script is like consistently has some really good gags throughout. It really muffs the ending, but you know,
disagree. No, wrong.
The last 5 minutes is dreadful. But
excellent, great ending.
No, so bad.
I liked it a lot more than you did.
But yeah, I think it's good. I'm not sure whether it would make my ballot at the end of the year. But I liked it. So that was that. What else did I watch? I watched. I'll tell you what I watched this week. Because I am hopefully going to be catching up on French Dispatch soon, because that's just dropped on Now TV. So I watched, finally got around to watching the Wes Anderson shorts on Netflix, the Henry Sugar Quartet. And I thought particularly the wonderful story of Henry Sugar, which was like the first one he dropped, that's, I guess, Benedict Cumberbatch is the protagonist of, but because it's Wes Anderson, it has a very Russian Doll structure and, you know, for like a stretch of it, Dev Patel's the protagonist. For a stretch of it, Ben Kingsley is. Ralph Fiennes is kind of like the outside of the nesting doll playing doll himself. And I was just so charmed by it. I liked all of them to a degree, but that was my, you know, favorite by a long stretch. Just for all the performances were incredible. And I know some people kind of rub up against the whole Wes Anderson shtick, and this is very much like him at his most Wes Anderson. But I thought it was great, and kind of I think probably enjoyed it more than I've enjoyed his last couple of movies. Mm. But I know that French Dispatch is, highly regarded.
You probably haven't seen Asteroid City yet.
Oh, sorry. Why I keep saying French Dispatch when I mean Asteroid City?
Oh, yeah.
I've seen everything else Wes Anderson. I just haven't seen Asteroid City yet.
Okay. Sure.
I think I keep saying French Dispatch because I've got Jeffrey Wright on the mind.
Let me ask you a French Dispatch question, because that will be the most recent theatrical feature you've seen that one. How do the shorts compare with? Because in some ways, French Dispatch is kind of three shorts.
Yeah, it is
a framing device. How do they compare?
I'm not the biggest French Dispatch fan. I think I am. I know you are. I think it's a little bit uneven. It's like Meineke Wes for me, but it's hard to compare them because these are like four separate short stories. There's no connective tissue other than Ralph Fiennes kind of being present, I think, in all of them as Dahl, but like in most of them to a very minor degree. There's one of them I think is you know not as strong as the others, but I think it really hit home for me how much of Dahl there is in Wes Anderson's storytelling impulses. And I'm not the biggest fan of his Fantastic Mr. Fox either. So I think maybe that's a reason why I hadn't got around to this sooner. But yeah, I was just really, really charmed. And the performance is great. Dev Patel needs to be in everything that Wes Anderson does from now on. He's perfect.
I wonder if Anderson is involved in, and I wonder if this is part of it, the, you know, the Netflix now, right, have like a long-term licensing plan on all the Dahl stuff. I think they
just own the rights, don't they, now?
Okay. So yeah, I wonder if that happened post this project coming together or pre, or, you know, and whether Anderson is going to be their main, you know, we'll see more Dahl adaptations from Netflix that Anderson will make, maybe features. Because he's just got Fantastic Mr. Fox and this. He hasn't actually made a live action feature of any Dahl stuff, right?
No. I don't know. If he was like, oh, I'm going to dig into the Dahl short stories and, you know, adapt one a year for the next 5 years, that would be great. I think the kind of the Wonka plans more broadly, I think it'll be like case by case. I don't think it'll be, you know, like they've got any kind of grand plan or that they, you know, reserving anything.
I thought they're doing like a connected universe. I thought that was the whole play,
Matilda was them, wasn't it?
Because that's based on the musical from whatever 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But I don't know whether I don't know whether that was. It was a Netflix release, though, wasn't it? That's what I mean. So maybe they they bought up the rights with that. But yeah, that Matilda's good too. Oh yeah, and then I just wanted to. I think probably the last thing I would shout out watching is. I watched for the first time the French Connection, and it fucking rules, doesn't it? It's great.
So good. Yeah.
So good. We got a Gene Hackman connection with the film we're about to discuss. Gene Hackman's amazing in it. I've watched a fair few Friedkin movies. I watched Sorcerer for the first time last year, just after he passed away, and kind of really dug that. And it's so visceral, so like scuzzy and 70s. I don't think I knew that Roy Scheider was in it, and he's fantastic. And Popeye Doyle's just such a scummy 70s cop, but like you're really rooted. You can kind of see as well, like in him, however many cop shows and movies that have followed about the guy that's just, he's too invested, he can't let go, and it might make him bad at his job rather than good, who knows. I thought it was great, and I was like, why have I waited 30 odd years to catch up with this movie? It's incredible.
Have you seen, do you want to talk for a minute on the car chase, which is kind of probably the most indelible thing from that movie? That's one of the most famous pieces.
Yeah, and I'd obviously seen clips of that before. I think what I hadn't... Oh, well, Alexa liked something I said then.
Big French Connection fan, is Alexa.
Yeah. I
prefer to.
I think what's really great about that sequence, though, is that the sniper attempt that kicks it off is really unexpected, like really out of the blue and really unpleasant. I didn't feel like the car chase was just around the corner at that moment in the movie. And then it happens, and you've got the parallel action of him on the ground and the guy on the train. And what's great about it is like the car chase is incredible and visceral, and but it's so good because they're both kind of fucking up. Like the villain on the train is increasingly losing control of the situation, but down on the ground as well, like Doyle is trying to keep up, but it's like smashing into cars here and there, and like, it's, you know, like by the time he gets there, he's like staggering out. It's kind of magnificent that this one of the greatest ever car chases is a car chasing kind of a shadow on a bridge above, and none of it's slick. It's just all, it's just shaggy like the movie. It's really entertaining. Sorcerer has a similarly, like, Sorcerer is, trucks going through the jungle, and there's one sequence on a bridge, this truck going over a wooden bridge in the jungle, which is just like heart stuffing. William Friedkin was a good filmmaker. I'm just gonna throw that out there.
I've got a point I want to make on that. But have you seen To Live and Die in L.A.? You seen that one?
I haven't.
Totally of a piece. You've got to watch that one.
Great. Okay.
I was going to say that that phrase, they don't make them like they used to, they don't make them like that anymore, or whatever. You know, that with the case of those movies and those sequences, it's not so much that they don't have the interest in making a movie like that anymore with practical effects and stuff. It's that they kind of legally couldn't film a sequence like that anymore. I'm trying to think of the most thrilling car stuff we get. Like, I'm trying to think, Ethan Hunt going around the Champs-Élysées on the bike in that Mission Impossible movie. Like, that is thrilling, and you feel the threat, and the stakes feel so high. And yet, the way they actually made that will be 100 times more controlled than the way that they shot that in French Connection. We'll never get that back, and so that's probably something to lament. The feeling of that movie, that they'll never, they just, that movie, they can't, you can't recreate the conditions that were there to make it like that again.
And that you know, it feels like it as well. Like, as much as, like, even in Dead Reckoning, which I watched since the last podcast, we like in that movie there's like a one of the car chase sequences where the joke is that, like, the driving is bad and the car's crashing into stuff on the street the whole way through. But, like, it all it feels controlled and it feels choreographed. And it also feels like, you know, that even some of the most visceral bits that you know, there is all kinds of CG enhancements here and there, whereas, like, French Connection, I'm sure there are visual effects involved, but
I'm not so sure. Like, what?
No, because they're not visual effects in the broadest possible sense, right? That you know, there are, you know, tricks of the camera and you know, perspective and stuff, but you feel like it's Gene Hackman in a car smashing into shit. It's great.
Yeah, so good. Anything else?
I mean, yes, but I probably should cut it off there.
Have you been watching? I feel like I need to ask this every time. Have you watched any old pornos, Joe? Yeah.
So to give context to the listeners,
Joe loves to watch these old pornos, and I'm asking him if he has done. So, Joe, you watching any old pornos this week?
No.
Okay. Cool. I've got two films and two plays. Ooh. Of the movies.
Oh, boo. London.
Boo! Boo!
Liberal elite.
I'm just mixing up. You cheered me last week when I said I watch TV. You went, yay! So,
did I?
You definitely did.
TV's democratic, Reese. Plays are elitist. Everyone knows that.
Well, okay. I watched American Fiction, which I liked more than you did, Joe. That's one of my movies. I kind of thought...
I wish we could talk spoilers. The last 5 minutes sucks. It's such a fumbling of the bag.
I really liked it. You know, hard to discuss. I thought
Adam Brody good though, right?
Adam Brody really good. I just loved the way the story unfurled. I felt like every scene sort of gave me something I wasn't expecting from beginning to end. I found the emotional stuff. You know, between his family, much more present in the movie than I was expecting, and it felt like Cord Jefferson. This felt like the debut of quite a interesting, no, a definitely really interesting filmmaker, and also to get all those great performances out of all those actors. I think I'm really excited to see his next project. And I thought it was great,
and I like him from, you know, the stuff that he's been involved with on the small screen as well, like his batting average is really good. What I really like about the script is the dialogue and the character stuff, the central character stuff. I couldn't help but feel so much of the family stuff around the side felt constructed to allow the central story. And it's weird because you're right. The balance of the story is there's much more of the family stuff in there than I thought there would be. But it felt very screen written that, like, this thing had to happen and this thing had to happen to make the central, I've written this parody story and now I kind of have to go with it on its success. Like, it was just everyone was perfectly placed around him to make that story, to give it some propulsion. And I just felt a little bit inauthentic to me. But I think the performances counteracts that for the most part. I do like it. I think I like it less than some people.
Yeah, I mean, it would make my ballot. Like, I think it was the last Best Picture movie that I hadn't seen, and then I ranked them all. And this, this is my third. This is my third favorite of the Best Pick noms. So I really, really, really liked it. I thought it was excellent. Anyway, I also saw Dune 2 today. Dune Part 2. Dune 2. I watched Dune 1 last night to refresh. Anyone else? You guys got plans to see Dune 2? You know, did you... Joe, you were talking before Mike about you didn't actually vibe that much with the first movie.
I saw the first movie at home because its cinema release was kind of in not great, like, life timing for me with children arriving, etc. So I watched it at home, and I've seen the David Lynch Dune, and I understand all of the like craft Oscars that were thrown at it. I mean, it's got like really thoughtful visual effects compared to almost any Hollywood competition. Well, any competition, right? The visual effects are stunning and really, like, I watched some VFX reels for it, and they're really, really well thought out as well. And I like Oscar Isaac's beard, and I like a lot of the actors in it. I liked it, but it didn't wow me, and it didn't thrill me the way that it seems to have other people. So I'm like, maybe I should revisit it before I see it before I see part two at the cinema. And I would like to see part two on the big screen, yeah.
James, what about you? Dune, no. Thoughts?
Dune doesn't interest me, especially in that quantity.
Why not, James? Because you're a nerd.
Yeah, you like.
I prefer stuff that isn't I don't know, borderline space fantasy. It's too much about the world building and about the lore of itself. Or at least that's the impression I get.
But wait, can I just ask, have you read the book? Have you seen the Lynch movie? Have you seen the first Denis movie?
Everything I see about Dune makes me think I would rather spend my time elsewhere. And I could be wrong, but okay. I don't feel sufficiently unenriched by the rest of my life to go, no, I'll give Dune a try when I don't feel the urge to. Yeah.
I don't know if earlier, but James has a girlfriend. So...
fiction, you know, there's stuff I enjoy and there's stuff I might enjoy. Life.
No, we believe she's real, James. Don't worry, it's fine.
Yeah, well, my life, I guess, is not as enriched as James's because
I would rather read crappy X-Men comics from the 90s than watch a sci-fi film that might be good because I know I'll enjoy one and not the other.
Okay, let me try and sell you then on Dune Part 2, at least. Which I thought was
I'll start with part two. Yeah, good idea.
Which I thought was a sort of muscular, epic, complex, rich text about a religious war. Basically, that's what the movie's about. That's what the book's about. But it really just digs into.
Does just fucking end though, doesn't it, Reese?
What do you mean?
The first movie, it does just end.
Sure. And I, again, having watched the first one last night, I almost can't believe they got away with making it like that. And making it so small.
Zendaya's in
small.
One scene of it, right? Yeah. It's insane. Yeah,
she's in a lot of this one.
Well, yeah, it stands to reason, given that she's one of the main characters in the story that was chopped in half and only made it into a scene of the first one.
This one felt really different to the first one. This one felt, you know, it's sort of an extended, it's kind of a war movie. If it has a genre, it's a kind of a war film. Like the story starts, I'm not going to say where it goes, but the story starts with Paul Atreides, who at the end of the first one kind of joins the Fremen after his family's been slaughtered by the evil Harkonnens. And he kind of joins up with the Fremen and is then in this sort of planetary war with the baddie Harkonnens that killed his dad. And then the second one is about much more. It's in the first one a bit as well, and then obviously it's in the book. Is this prophecy of a messiah, and they've got all these various words for that character in the story. Mudhadid, Quatchit, Havarach, all these kind of crazy words that I'm sure I got wrong just there. But and there's all this stuff about how this idea of this messiah that's going to save this indigenous people was actually planted by this religious sect that also is the sect that Paul's mum belongs to, and there are all these familial links between the great houses of the universe, and there's all these bits, and also there's lots of explosions, and there's laser guns, and there's there's sort of magic scenes and big huge scale battles, and Austin Butler's got a bald head in it, and Lea Seydoux is in it, and she's new, and Florence Pugh's in it, and Christopher Walken's in it in the new one. But really, I just found it a very interesting script and a detailed look at how religious fervosity drives conflict, you know, and that's true in our true world today, and as it has ever been since Herbert wrote the book. So I'm sure, you know, it's all there in what spurred him on to write it. But I found that stuff really interesting intellectually, and then it's just a thrilling 2.5-hour sci-fi movie that I found pretty exceptional. And then there are some incredible sequences in there, some really insane, just amazingly put together action and thrilling and tense sequences in ways that, you know, very few filmmakers that I've, you know, very few films that I've seen of late can get to it. So a highly recommended for me, Dune Part 2.
I have an important question.
Mm-hmm.
Does the quality of the Dune movies, do they make you finally willing to admit that John Carter is bad?
John Carter's good.
I actually
thought about John Carter today watching Doom.
Yeah, of course you did. This is how you do this coherently and competently.
No, I should watch that again today. John Carter, good. John Carter, good.
Rhys and I walked out of a screening of John Carter and looked at each other and we went, right? Yeah. And then Rhys was like, so good, right? And I was like, what?
John Carter, good. No, the John Carter reevaluation project is right around the corner. I can feel it. I can feel it coming. I can see it. I can see a Godzilla X Kong the New Empire style movie in 5 years. Dune X John Carter crossover. Get Taylor Kitsch back. Get Timmy in there. I can feel it. It's gonna happen.
I think John Carter is worse than Jim Carter.
Jim Carter from Downton Abbey.
No, the
Jim Carter.
It's not a name. Jim Carter. It's the gymnastics martial arts movie.
I'm pretty sure Jim Carter also plays the.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he's in Wonka.
You keep your name out of you keep Jim Carter's name out of your motherfucking mouth. That's what I would say.
Jim Carter starring in a Jim Carter remake would be fantastic.
That would be fun. And then I saw two plays. I'll talk about them quick. They were both musicals. There was one called The Little Big Things. That was the Soho Place, which is the newest or the first West End theatre built in 50-odd years, which is really cool. It was in the Round, 600 seats in the Round, which you don't normally see in the West End.
And
It's at the new Tottenham Court Road development.
Yeah,
thing.
Oh, cool. That place, yeah, it sucks. It's an eyesore, Reese. It's an eyesore. I don't know about eyesore. The theatre. The whole redevelopment of that area is horrendous.
Well, I can't speak for the eyesore of the site itself, but the theatre was nice. It's owned by... I can't remember her name, but she owns also NIMAX Theatres. And the musical was really excellent. It was about this. It was based off of a memoir. So it was a true story of this 17-year-old boy who, in 2007, I think, if I can recall, he was on a holiday with his brothers and he fell into the ocean, hit his head, and got paralyzed from the neck down.
Oh.
And so the musical kind of that event happens about a quarter of the way through. And then the structure of the thing is. It's narrated by this wheelchair bound actor who is portraying sort of the current version of Henry in conversation with the pre-accident version of him, and they are sort of Greek chorus, you know, narrating the family story of what happened after his accident, and so heavy stuff, but great songs, some really sort of fantastic whiz bang stuff, you know, the there's one bit where the wheelchair lead actor kind of starts flying in the sky. It was great. And there's the confetti cannons. but it was a really affecting, I found it a very affecting story. I cried loads and the songs were great. And yeah, it's just wrapped. So even if you were sold by that, you can't see it. Talk about really bullshit. But I think it just had the whiff of it to me of,
When's it dropping on Netflix?
I think it had the whiff to me of a Dear Evan Hansen, which is to say, I guess that means that the lead actor will portray himself at 17 in 15 years' time, CGI down.
What was that called? Really sorry? Good.
It's called The Little Big Things. Really good. And then I saw a shitty musical, but one that you might have heard of because it's higher profile, that to me it links back to what you were saying, James, about the bathroom documentary. It just felt like, oh, you like this music? Well, here it is. So I went to see the Live Aid musical that's called Just for One Day. I don't know if you're aware of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It kind of made me angry. It sort of pissed me off because the main character is
you
Bob
hate
Geldof.
Charity, right?
The main character was Bob Geldof, and yes, it's true that I think 10% of ticket profits go to the actual Live Aid charity. Now, who knows? You know, who knows if it's all, you know, it's a tax write-off and there's never a profit made on any ticket sold to that show, although I was in the Old Vic, you know, and it was a sold-out house, but who knows. And it was, I just found it a very cynical sort of cash grab hagiography on Geldof, really, because it starts and the actor playing Geldof is very like, oh, no, I'm not a hero, or I don't make this about me. It's not about me. It's about the famine. Both then and now. And yet the play is all about him. It's just all about him and how he's a hero and how it was all his idea. And then there's for my favorite sort of, and interspersed by the way with sort of all these musical sequences of the famous songs played at the concert, and then the Band-Aid song as well in the first half. They kind of do that, and they have people who are playing Boy George and playing McCartney and sort of doing covers of those songs, and you know, yes, Let It Be is a good song. We Will Rock You is a pretty good song, but I don't know that a play built in with that as the context needs to exist in 2024. My favourite bit, though, and I'll end on this, is that there's one sequence in the second half where they're trying to tell him, the characters in the play are trying to tell Geldof that he has to sing the I Don't Like Mondays song that he did actually sing in Live Aid. And he's going like, no, it's not about me and nobody knows me and I'm not famous compared to all these other singers. I shouldn't sing the song, no way. And then he finally gets convinced that it's actually the right thing to do, it's the heroic thing to do, he should sing the song. And then there is a properly like 7-minute version of him singing the song at the concert in the play, and it's all kind of amped up and it's like a feel-good thrilling moment, but actually I thought it was all a bit embarrassing. That's Just for One Day, that you can see but you shouldn't. That's playing the Old Vic for probably a while. Okay. So that's our what we've been watching bit, which went rather lengthy. So we'll do the news chunk quick, but actually a nice segue from that into this. So the news piece that's interested me this week is the Beatles story, the Beatles movie story. Did you guys see this?
4 movies.
So this is it's Sony announced that Sam Mendes is going to be directing 4 interconnected Beatles musicals. It's basically each centered around each of the 4 Beatles. I think, and then a more recent story that only came out a few days ago kind of revealed that they'll all be shot together probably next year and then released the year after. They'll all be released within a pretty tight window. And I don't know, this to me, it connects with recent sort of storylines in this podcast of, you know, the link how the TV and film sort of blur into each other consistently about release schedules. It's about the musical biopic and the kind of, you know, the ever rise of that, you know, the Amy Winehouse movie is out pretty soon. And it's also about, it's sort of a connected universe, you know, it's a cinematic universe story as well, right? It's unclear how they'll all interact, but I don't think they'll be straight sort of sequels, prequels to each other. I think they will all be set. They will all tell the life of that Beatle. And I guess the 3 other actors playing the other Beatles will all sort of play in each other's movies. And so I just think it's an interesting project. It's a bit cynical, but I don't know. I don't know what James, what do you think about that?
I mean, it's definitely interesting. What I find most surprising is the idea that these 4 movies might share scenes and sequences, and then maybe you'll see context, you know, like alternate versions.
Like Arrested Development Series 4.
Yeah, exactly.
Hopefully they'll get them in the same room for this one.
But like, also the thing I lie awake thinking about is, what order do they release them in? Because like, if you put Ringo out first, you might poison people on the rest, but if you put him out last, you know,
I think you do. I think John and Paul are your bookends, and then you do Ringo and George.
That's
middle,
what I was
I
thinking.
Guess.
I reckon John, Ringo, George, Paul. That's my expectation.
And have you got any, you know, do you think, my gut is that they'll cast complete unknowns for the four, I think. But if they don't, if they go one sub up from that, you know, can you think of anyone particularly that could play any of the four guys?
I mean, casting is not my thing. I imagine, based on the state of, like, his career, I imagine Benedict Cumberbatch will be like, oh, it's a biopic, I'm in. He's done about 50 of the fucking things.
He's way too old. I mean, I think they'll pick a 30-year-old, I think.
Yeah, no, I don't know who'll be in it. And, you know, I already feel slightly exhausted at the prospect of that discourse lasting an entire 12-month period.
I mean, yeah, you said 12 months. Actually, it's more like 2 years from now, because if they're going to film next year and then put them out the year after that, then you're talking about casting shit for the next year, then production stuff, then they release them.
Then they come out. And, you know, if they're a flop, that's a lot to commit to, isn't it? Four movies.
Well, it's a bit, I mean, again, in this Hollywood Reporter piece that I'm just reading before, it kind of connects this idea with the Kevin Costner Horizon two-parter that's coming out this summer as a sort of a, you know, yeah, these are bigger bets than, you know, than before, but maybe to win big, you've got to bet big. And that's just the state of the industry at the moment. Joe, I don't know if you have any thoughts.
So I think I would probably be more charitable to the idea of this not being a gimmick if Sam Mendes wasn't coming off the back of one of the biggest gimmick movies of the past couple of decades, because 1917 is that's all it's got going for it. Is
was that his last film?
I think so. Think so. I've always been a little bit up and down with Sam Mendes. He made two Bond movies, obviously, and like, one was really great and one was pretty wretched. Some of his early career.
You're forgetting something, by the way. You are forgetting a film. Oh, has he made, just last year, my friend.
Has he made something since?
Yes, it's Empire of Light.
Oh god, yeah, which I skipped because I was like, I saw Belfast already. I'll keep my palate dry for the Fablemans when I'm going through that mini genre. I don't really know how this will work. The thing also that made me kind of skeptical was the suggestion in the original news story that this will kind of span the like the life of the Beatles, so like the decade lifespan of the Beatles, and like end in 1970 when the band breaks up. And like, sure, for John and Paul, that would make a lot of sense. If you want to make an interesting Ringo movie and a really interesting George movie, you kind of have to go past that. And so,
surely they will.
I think they will. Like, surely that announcement was just a kind of placeholder while they're actually being written, right?
Yeah, and unless potentially, I guess you could do some stuff where like there is a superstructure that spans the life of the Beatles, and then the individual movies kind of flash around in time in their lives, perhaps. But yeah, I don't know. It feels a bit gimmicky. It feels risky, but I guess. You know, I'm not averse to digging into the Beatles more. They were, probably still are the greatest band of all time, and I love their music, and I like, you know, reading about them and watching movies about them. So,
they're no Foo Fighters,
I'll definitely give it a go.
They're no Foo Fighters.
I wonder if, just as we're talking, I wonder if what this will end up being, even though I said they'll all speak to each other, I wonder whether this gets rounded down a bit in terms of ambitions, a bit more to be a straight kind of, they'll each tell kind of a chronological chapter of the story, right? Because you could kind of, you know, you could almost do it based on how long they lived for, right? You could kind of do your Lennon movie first, and then you could do the first chunk of the actual Beatles story in that one.
You'd have to finish off one of the Beatles to make that work.
Yeah, otherwise you've got to release Paul and Ringo simultaneously.
Yeah, sure. I think you do John, George, Ringo, Paul, and then you could, I think you could slightly do this, the actual chronology. You could make them sequels to each other, basically, is what I'm saying. I do think this does feel to me like the obvious end point of the recent musical biopic boom. You know, like, this is the most lucrative music catalog after maybe Michael Jackson, but they're doing a Michael Jackson movie. Probably.
is the Michael Jackson movie like estate approved?
Oh yes, and not only that, hold on, let me just get up the details on that, because there are details. So it's directed by Antoine Fuqua, point number one. Point number two is it actually stars Jafar Jackson, who is the nephew of Michael Jackson.
All right, okay, so it's not going to be very interesting then.
And it's also, yes, it's completely sort of sanctioned and signed off by the Jackson estate. So yeah, it won't contain all of the scheme shit. And which will make it less interesting, yes. And that's same with the Amy Winehouse one, same with Rocket Man and Bohemian Rhapsody. But I think this Beatles project is probably just the logical endpoint of this wave. And it also your brain thinks, like, just assumes that there's been a Beatles biopic, but there hasn't been, and there will be a huge audience for this, for sure. And I guess they've got to get this out before all the boomers die, basically, right? They've probably kind of got to they've got to get a project like this out in the next decade, because otherwise your moment might have passed. Anybody else got on that? Anybody got anything else on the Beatles movie, or shall we move on?
Let's move on.
We're moving on to, and it's good that we kept this short, this bit, at 50 minutes, because we're about to discuss a 3.5-hour movie.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Where to even start with this one? So,
I think you should start by summarizing the political situation in Russia at the turn of the 20th century. And just give us a quick overview of the Bolshevik Revolution, if you could.
Let me the context I will give. I'll give two bits of context, and then we'll get into the chat. And I kind of took five little note chunks that are things I'd like to talk about in this conversation. But for context, I think the one important context is Warren Beatty's career up until this point. So it's 1981, and he had made this. He's the star, producer, writer, and the director of this. He actually only ends up directing five movies, so this is the second of five. He made Heaven Can Wait, which he also starred in a few years before, and he goes on to make Dick Tracy, Bulworth, and Rules Don't Apply. So it's, I think it's fair to say that those later three were not, you know, were not regarded particularly well. And this is really his, this is probably his peak as a director, I'd say, this moment.
I think it's worth mentioning as well with Beatty, though, that he did have kind of a reputation for kind of being very involved behind the scenes on lots of his movies, and perhaps, you know, may have shadow directed some of them, or, you know, certainly tried to throw his weight around a bit.
Fair. But I also think interesting in context is him as a star, because I also think this is kind of the last, this is in some ways his apex as a star as well, perhaps, because really, you know, really he breaks out in Bonnie and Clyde, which is in 1967. He then, I think what's interesting, and I don't think I realized this before looking yesterday at his Wikipedia, is he just didn't make that many movies. His filmography is just much more limited than you think. He's left a bigger footprint in the culture than his filmography would suggest.
He was too busy fucking.
Yeah, probably. Probably. So he makes Bonnie and Clyde in 67, and then you've got McCabe and Mrs. Miller in 71. Parallax View in 74, Shampoo in 75, and then Heaven Kuwait in 78, and Reds in 81. And then, you know, in terms of the stuff he makes afterwards, Ishtar, which I actually think is quite good, is in 87, but that was a big, big bomb. And then I used the movies he directed and follow that. And so yeah, this is probably his peak as a Hollywood person. So that's point one. I think he'd been trying to get this movie made for like a decade, you know, and then the movie starts and you can see why both those things are relevant, that A, this was as powerful as he got in Hollywood, and B, it took him a while to crack this, because boy oh boy, is it a big, just a complex, dense, really grown up story about, you know, I'd say it's primarily about this relationship between, so he plays a real guy whose name is John Reed, who was a journalist at the turn of the century.
They all play real guys, and then there's
who meets at the start of the story, character called Louise Bryant,
yeah.
And she's married at the time, but he kind of just intrigues her enough, and she leaves her husband in like the first 10 minutes of the movie to go gallivanting off with him. And they are part of the New York intellectual scene, political scene. And Jack Nicholson as Eugene O'Neill comes into that. And I don't know about you guys, I was under the impression this was much more of a three-hander with Nicholson, but it kind of doesn't end up being that. What the movie really is it's this relationship between these two characters, these two kind of intellectual heavyweights in some ways, but it's this, you know, kind of romance between these two characters that's sort of set alongside the real story of John Reed, in that he is one of the only Americans who is in Russia at the time of the October Revolution, at the end of World War One and the overthrowing of the Russian government, and he's there and he witnesses it, and then he writes this book, and then that, I don't know, that probably happens about two thirds of the way through the movie that moment happens, maybe even half, and then the sort of wrap up of the story is I found at times very hard to follow, kind of where he was, whether he was in Russia or Poland or back in the US, what he was doing and why he gets involved in politics. Or does he sort of torn between himself as a journalist covering the story and as a wannabe politician trying to steer the revolution in Russia, but also back in the US? And Paul Sorvino comes in for a chunk as this other sort of left wing political firebrand who I could barely understand. But yeah, all with the spine of their relationship, of their romance, trying to tell this kind of, you know, epic romance on the canvas of history, a bit of a Dr. Zhivago type. And yeah, I found it dense. I found it, as they say, handsomely mounted. But I think I had trouble with the romance.
So I disagree. I like the romance. I like the film in general. I do think we should, though, point out before we get too deep into this, because you've just done like a very long plot synopsis.
Well, for context, listeners, I that we had a technical issue and James and Joe could not get through to me. So I was just there and I was just going and I was going and I was going and I was waiting for someone to interrupt me and it didn't come. So if that last chunk felt a little bit just freight train, it's because the brakes had broken on the freight train.
That's not true, James. James, cut that out from the edit. Don't. It's not accurate. Reese was just—he was just ranting and raving about the plot of the movie. He said something about it being handsomely mounted. No, what we really need to talk about is the running time.
Yes.
This movie is so long that I watched the first hour of it last night. And what I had left to watch today was still an hour longer than Shortcomings. It's it feels long, but I dug it, and I loved the you know, kind of luxuriating this movie that you're like. Sometimes I watch a movie and go, well, they wouldn't make this now. This would be a mini-series. And I go, they wouldn't make this as a mini-series now.
They absolutely would not.
But it's it's great. Like, it's just, and it's got, it's so dense, and I knew so little about this subject matter coming in, other than I was like, oh, I wonder whether we'll see Rasputin. my knowledge of this is kind of where it intersects with the animated movie Anastasia. I kind of followed it the whole way through, and I didn't expect to, and I was like, I was with it, and I was kind of, I felt like I had a sense of what the characters were fighting for at any given time, what was kind of like going on in America versus in Europe, and like, and the kind of the political and the bureaucratic machinations, and I was like, well, you know, fair play, if you're going to make this movie 3.5 hours long, I'm thrilled that you've been able to construct it in such a way that I can stay with it. And then I thought that it had obviously taken these real life characters at the center of the story, who, you know, obviously some of this will have been true for them, and some of it will have been, you know, dramatically enhanced. But they've also got these talking heads who were kind of, you know, now older people who were around at the time and part of the socialist movement in the teens and 20s. I was so impressed by how complex those characters were at the center of it, and how, you know, kind of like they were really complicated characters who, you know, kind of at all times were kind of, you know, had noble aims. But I loved the way that they kind of dug out the, you know, maybe some of the pretensions or some of the, you know, the personal motivations behind doing these things at the same time. And then you've got Jack Nicholson just strolling into like three scenes in the movie and just fucking chewing it. The scene he has with Diane Keaton in the middle of the movie where he just like eviscerates her, but in such a sad and kind of like, I am eviscerating you, but what I'm really doing is eviscerating myself for being so obsessed with you. And I would give up all of my ideals in an instant for, you know,
bad actress
to be cuckolded by you, basically. Yeah, incredible. I had a really good time with it.
Yeah, I felt similar in that, like, it was so long, and yet, like, you kind of
really does bear repeating how long this movie is.
It becomes sort of like, once you surrender to the story, it becomes kind of immersive, and like you know you live in it, and you notice like subtle things,
and it's deliberately paced as well. It's not like not like it has slow sections or fast sections. It is like a consistent march throughout. It never leaves you behind, but it never pulls you along its running time either.
And I agree with Reese actually that I think the love story aspect was a bit, it felt a bit like, you know, someone was like, oh, let's do Casablanca, but now, like, let's update it. And for me, the thing, like, if you're doing historical epic, like, you don't necessarily need to tie it to something that personal. Like, what I appreciate about this movie was it sort of is like intellectual tone, in that it was really complex and, like you say, it dug into some sort of weighty ideas. And it didn't like pander. It was just going, listen, we're going to get into some really complicated stuff about, like, the, you know, global socio-political rise of, like, communism, basically. And that it can do that and, like Joe was saying, bring, like, the personal focus on this guy and the people around him. Although, personally, I think for about the first three quarters, this is a biopic of Louise Bryant. And John Reed is a secondary character in it. And then at the final act, it turns into his movie. And I was like, no, you made a mistake there.
I think that's a problem with it.
I thought it was fairly even-handed. But yeah, I guess she's our route into the story.
But like my concern is that having watched the movie, I'm like, John Reed was a less compelling character than she was.
Yeah.
Reading Wikipedia, her life gets only more interesting. And I was sort of like, why? John Reed is like an uninteresting person who was in an interesting situation. That's true to an extent for most of them, but she's the one who really interested me. Like, because on top of everything that was going on, she had like the feminist movement in America happening as well. And they could have dug into that more, because like I know a weird amount about this situation because I'm currently reading Jill Lepore's book about Wonder Woman, in which like John Reed and Louise Bryant turn up in that book because they were in the same circles as Margaret Sanger and William Moulton Marsden. Like, you know, it was all overlapping. And in fact, later in the narrative, like, they decouple the communists and the feminists because, you know, they're getting the wrong end of the political situation in America. But I found that really interesting, like, knowing what was going on in the fringes. I would have loved to have seen more of that in here.
I do wonder whether, when you say interesting character, I think, you know, maybe she had more interesting stuff going on. I think within the context of this movie, what drives him, I think, is really important, is really compelling, and the kind of the kind of the accusations that she throws at him, right, when they're having those arguments.
About three quarters in, when she's like, do you want to be a journalist or a revolutionary? Like,
well, yeah, but so do you want to be a journalist or a politician or a revolutionary? But also, you know, like, are you going out there because you believe in these ideals, or because you believe in yourself, you know, because you want to report the truth, or do you want to editorialize, or do you want to just be the guy who's on stage and everyone's cheering? And I think there's a kind of a sense of all of that to that guy. I think probably like his struggle to commit to her versus to commit to himself. Cause like there's talk in the movie about he's off having affairs, but we never see them. But her affair is really, really pivotal in the movie. And that's because I don't think, like, it's not important that he's out there fucking other women. It's that he's out there doing the shit he wants to do rather than like following her dreams, because he's the main character in his own story. And it's that final act, and it's that distance between them. Obviously the final of 17 acts. But that distance between them that kind of, I think, starts to put things into perspective from a little bit.
Mm.
So I did find both characters compelling, but I think you're right that the perspective of the movie certainly shifts in the final third.
It's a very interesting Beatty movie. You know, it's sort of, because to have made this, to have taken this long to make it, to have, you know, put all your chips in, to sort of spend all your political capital in Hollywood, kind of, in a way, it sounds like, in a way, to make this. I'm still not sure, even after having watched it and discussed it, sort of, you know, what was it about this story that he was so drawn to tell? And it's in what you guys have just mentioned. It's in that sort of, a bit of it is, he, I'm sure, connects with this sort of man who loves the spotlight and loves to be out there adventuring. But what are his actual ideals? Does he have an ideology, or is he just hogging the spotlight? And I kind of, for me, maybe that is an idea that the movie could have run out a bit more. I think, you know, making it a bit more of a personal reflection of Beatty, the movie star at the time. I think there's some really interesting comparisons with this too. And this is not why I chose to watch this movie, but there's some really interesting comparisons with Maestro, which I don't know, James, have you seen Maestro?
No.
But Joe, I know Joe has, and I think me and you, Joe, didn't you know, do not think that much of Maestro. But you know, Maestro is
it's one of those movies that you're like, I'm glad that exists. I'm glad that Bradley Cooper took as wild a swing at it as he did. I just don't think it's ultimately successful. But right. I mean, like, yeah, I can absolutely see the parallels you're about to draw.
Yeah, it's his second film as a director. He's the star and producer and writer of that. It's about a great man in history and who he plays. It's also, I think, very, the sort of Louise and Carey Mulligan characters are, there's interesting parallels there where Cooper has tried to make Bernstein's wife, the kind of focus of the film and the focus of the marketing of the film, but in reality it is Bernstein's story. And I think in some ways Red's reminded me of that a bit, that there's so often these shots of the camera kind of looking at Diane Keaton, who we have mentioned plays Louise. I think that it's the best performance in the movie, I think. Oh, I guess Nicholson blows everyone out of the water, but it's excellent, and I think she's better than Beatty. But there's lots of scenes of watching her watch him do the actual important thing in the scene, as though the movie is kind of trying to say, almost to James's point, this is Louise's story, but the movie isn't that, and it was never that. The story was always his story. So I found those parallels interesting. It's also, there's obviously an Oppenheimer parallel here. The length and the you know, all the kind of communist stuff, the density, there's some interesting stuff there. Killers of the Flower Moon, I think, is in the mix too. So it feels a very interesting movie to watch in the context of this award season, to be honest. And I didn't know that going in.
I think so still not seen Oppenheimer, but I'm aware of the central theme of Oppenheimer because I'm aware of who Oppenheimer is and what he did. And there is that kind of, and I think this is probably what was interesting to Beatty at the time and why he wanted to make this movie. There is that interesting moment for kind of everyone involved in the third act, for Keaton and for Beatty and for the friend who gets deported to Russia, is it EG?
Yes.
Who they all start to question the cause that they've dedicated their life to. But I think to different degrees question it. And kind of, you know, whether this communist cause and whether this, you know, empowering the workers and, you know, kind of trying to launch some kind of global pushback against capitalism, whether it was the right thing to do or whether this was the right means to fight it, you know, because when they start seeing how kind of easily the system is able to be corrupted. And, you know, I guess if you think about it from like an American politic, you know, kind of American lens of their politics of the 20th century and also Hollywood as well, right? That this is depicting the 20s, I guess the fallout from the Second World War into the Cold War, which, you know, is still maybe not its height, but not far off when this film is being made.
You mean in the 80s when they're making it?
The Cold War is, you know, kind of
ongoing.
Still ongoing. Mm. And that Beatty came up in Hollywood kind of in that post-McCarthy era, when, and I know McCarthyism was something that, you know, affected all walks of American political life and lots of different, you know, different people, but particularly in Hollywood, you know, the people that were blacklisted and the effect that had on the industry. And I think, you know, probably some of the people that, you know, were kind of pushed to the side and, you know, never really were able to come back when New Hollywood took over. I can see why it was such a compelling story for Beatty, especially, you know, in kind of positioning these people as the heroes. I think it's really complex. It's a really complex story to tell, and I kind of would have loved to have been a fly on the wall back at the time when it was being released to see how people were reacting to Beatty, you know, telling this story.
I tell you what I want to be a fly on the wall of, which is, on the Wikipedia page, it mentions that there was a private screening for Ronald Reagan, who was president at the time.
Interesting.
I would have loved to know what he made of this movie. Like, part of me thinks it cheaps out a bit in that by the end, it sort of goes, yeah, socialism doesn't work. Look, he, you know, dies forgotten in a Russian overcrowded hospital of something super curable. But, like, you know.
It does, but it also kind of goes to pains to say, like, it hasn't worked because of the outside forces that are hell-bent on making sure it doesn't work.
And also it hasn't worked in Russia because the corruption and set, you know, that is endemic in Russian politics sets in immediately.
Well, and then, you know, the outside factors that they're talking about, like, you know, like America and Britain and France, you know, kind of being invested in this failing and you know, kind of cutting Russia off from the world. And then, you know, the stuff at the end in Baku and the kind of the speech they give, the speech he gives that is wrongly translated, that references Holy War. And then you think about kind of, you know, the complex geopolitics of Russia and America in the Middle East and how that has played out over the next century. Just like, oh yeah,
made me think of was
there's a real Wikipedia rabbit hole you could go down here that never ends.
Well, so I did watch the last 20 minutes of this after I got back from Dune 2, and that included that sequence. And yeah, I thought that's what Dune 2 is all about. So we are still telling these stories. We're still trying to, still having these same debates. You know, Russia is. Russia now in the war that they're involved with and the politics there and the way we talk about the way we talk about AI and technology and late stage capitalism, and it's, you know, these debates are, you know, by no means resolved. In fact, perhaps they're even more live than they were in 1981, perhaps, right? Because this is, you know, the Berlin Wall comes down in 1989, so you're in the latter chunk of that, and then there's the whole, you know, end of history moment. So Beatty Beatty making this in 1981 is, yeah, it's not that far away from that moment. And then obviously the 30 years since, things have gotten more complicated. I also think there's an interesting piece with all of that of, you know, this is a film, this is a film that on some degree, on some deep level of the film is a critique of capitalism, but released by Paramount Pictures that made $40 million in 1981.
Did you see the
movie stars? That's an interesting, you know, what does that mean?
Did you see who the copyright is held by? Because it was the most hilariously long company.
No.
I took a shot of it. The copyright for this movie is held by
Barclays Mercantile Industrial Finance Limited.
Great.
Well, and I was reading Ebert's review earlier, and that's how he ends his review, saying spotting the same thing and saying that John Reed would have liked that. So that's interesting too. It's always, you know, you
look at movies like Wall-E, which are like these Wall-E, this you know, criticism of capitalism, and you know, this massive corporation that ended up kind of destroying everything on Earth, released by the Walt Disney Company. Yeah, buy your Blu-ray on Amazon now.
Yeah.
Can I just talk quickly about the Talking Heads?
Yes.
Because I thought they were a really interesting device. However, I think getting a bunch of people who are probably at best octogenarians to talk about the events of 60 years ago turned out to not be the best use of everyone's time. Because could chop those out to a large extent and get rid of some of the length of this film.
I really waxed and waned with it. When it started, I was like, I'm not sure what I think about this. I think there are times where it adds some really, you know, kind of
times,
like...
yeah.
There are times where it adds, like, interesting kind of context around the margins that you're kind of glad that the movie doesn't go into, and kind of, you know, you can allow these people to speculate on, oh, this may or may not have happened, or this may, and the movie can just carry on without getting bogged down by stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Reminded me a lot of When Harry Met Sally.
You know, when you've got
older couples in that reminiscing about their about when they met. But yeah, as I kind of with you, but I also thought in some moments I was like, you're right, James, you could just cut them all out, but then you're like, oh, would Beatty have had to add in a 5-minute scene instead of that aside right there?
The thing I wonder is, would you have lost a lot of the humour if you cut them out? Because those people, they're just happy someone's listening to them. It's like when Anna was in the room when I was watching it, and she said it was like interview hour at the Springfield retirement home.
But also, they were living like in this incredibly interesting place at this incredibly interesting time, and involved in this radical movement. Yeah, you kind of do want to hear what they've got to say.
I don't know. I do think that the idea is better than the execution. Because listeners, if you haven't seen the movie, and you probably haven't. You know, for context, the movie starts, and you get, and because I noticed it, the credits, because you get the main credits, and then it says witnesses, and it lists, like, I think 3 pages of like 20 people. So we're talking about 50 odd people. And then really quickly you get this, and the image is much crisper than the actual shot on film bit. And it's just these old people on a completely black background with no name or context, like title card. And they're just talking about sometimes quite esoterically related things, and you know, like quick little clips, and then it's about every 10 or 15 minutes that you kind of go to these witnesses, and they're talking about some stuff. I did think what he was trying to do was, I think, if you're being, not cynical, not the right word, if you're being forget the word, he's trying to sort of uplift the stories and these two people's importance, I think. Whereas I do wonder, the way the movie ends with Reed dead in a, you know, sort of dead in a Russian prison, excuse that a bit. And I just wonder whether Reed and his what he did, why is this not a movie about Lenin or Trotsky, or like why it was like Beatty's connected somehow with this guy. And he's trying to say, this is going to be worth 3.5 hours of your time. This guy's story. Look, you know, look at all these people that knew them, and look at the way that they remember these people. And I'm just not, for me, the movie by the end of it hadn't convinced me that it was a story worth telling for that long. I'm not sure. Whereas again, you comp it to, I'm going to comp it to Killers of the Flower Moon. I don't know if other guys have seen that. That's also a story about characters lost to memory, real people lost to the history books now. But by the end of that 3.5 hour film, I felt like that had justified its existence and the choice of picking that story to tell. Whereas I'm not sure I got there with this.
That I fully agree with that assessment. Like the thing I thought at the end was like, excuse me, I was like, that was a good movie, but why him? Why that story? Mm. Why not take it from a different angle? Like I think you're right that, you know, he connected somehow with John Reed, and that's why that's the answer to the question. But whether he helped me connect with John Reed, I think is less successful.
And then, yeah, if you then look at the movies that Beatty makes after that, it's kind of, it's not like he then makes 10 biopics where he's the lead. You know, it's not, when you made that joke about Benedict Cumberbatch earlier. He seems to be drawn to this man. And you'd almost like to, you know, I'm almost now driven to apparently that what's it called? Star, the Peter Biskin book from 5 odd years ago. That's a Beatty biopic that's supposed to be really, really good. It's by the guy who wrote Easy Riders, Raging Bulls and Down and Dirty Pictures. Just a really good, like, Hollywood writer, and he hasn't done any other biopics other than this one, I don't think. And I've always been interested in Warren Beatty for sure, and it makes me want to read that book because I bet you in there's lots of insights as to why this film, why this story, why this time. But I didn't get that enough from the film. I'm just going to look over my little notes that I'd made.
While you're doing that, I've got a point to make. God, they're all so incredibly hot.
Yeah.
I know it's a very Joe point to make, but my God, I mean, Beatty and Keaton are just, like, gorgeous. And then...
And the suits, the chunk when they're at the beach house and they've got all these gorgeous, like, white linen suits.
Yeah.
They just look amazing. They look incredible, and all their bohemian friends, and they're doing, like, Eugene O'Neill plays in the top
hats
room.
And the fur coats, yeah. Oh, but, you know, so Keaton leaves her husband for Jack Reed, really, you know, kind of within the first couple of scenes of the movie. Mm-hmm. And one of the sexiest scenes I've ever seen, they're walking down the street and she suddenly just drops to her knees in front of him and says,
I want to see you with your pants off.
I'm thinking about what you do. Yeah, I want to see you with your pants off. And you're like, oh my God, this is like somebody fanned me down. And then like Warren Beatty, one of the prettiest men of all time, right? Mm. He's just, and like, you know, kind of one of the most legendary swordsmen in Hollywood until Annette Bening finally tamed him. And you're like, you know, there was rumors for years, wasn't there? Like that there was a tunnel connecting the Playboy Mansion to Warren Beatty's house. And then Jack Nicholson walks on screen and you're like, yeah, I get why she would, but not because he's like as conventionally attractive, just because he's just got this energy.
Just the charisma,
smolders.
Right?
He's so still and so deliberate in everything that he has to say. And real stealthy hot movie, the 3.5 hour Bolshevik biopic.
And Diane Keaton is like really beautiful. You kind of,
she's stunning. Yeah, she's Diane Keaton.
And you get why, you know, the first hour or maybe even longer of the film is kind of interested in, and again, probably I wish it was a bit more interested in, but it's interested in just this woman as a magnet for these men, you know, at least these two men. And you get why the camera loves her.
I think it's very funny how Eugene O'Neill leaves the film by trekking across Finland with her to go to a prison where Reed isn't being held anymore. And then she goes on to Russia and he's like, listen, even for me, this is too much. I'm going back home.
There's never any sign off, right? He's just,
no, that's it. He's just gone.
He's just gone.
Yeah.
What's interesting though. So I you watch this and you go, oh, Nicholson's in the midst of his like hot era, but actually, two films after this, he makes Terms of Endearment. And then from then on, he's playing the older version of Nicholson that we have in our memory a bit. So this is his last at-bat when he's just this fucking smouldering smoke show with the crazy good moustache and cool suits.
We're just analysing his hotness now. But I mean, I'm right about Nicholson, right? He's not like a conventionally super handsome guy, nowhere near the level that that Beatty is. And he's you know, he's got the receding hairline and the slightly, you know, the slightly manic look that Nicholson always had. it's an energy. He's so every time he walks onto the screen in this movie, you're like, yep, I get
Joe,
it.
Joe, I'll use a modern phrase. He's got the riz.
Well, I don't know.
He's a bit of a riz master. it's short for charisma. It means he has it.
Oh, is that true? I know.
Yeah, you did know that. Did you honestly know that?
No, obviously it's not a word that I've ever contemplated saying out loud. So I've not dug into its etymology.
You've got kids. They will at some point be by the time your kids are talking like that, there will be new phrases for those things. But you'll be in the youth speak in about 5 years, I suspect. But you've got a ways to go. You've got a ways to go with many versions of Riz Master General between now and then.
Wow.
I think it's worth. It's probably worth mentioning the production design and the scale of the story and the locations, because there are lots of talking in rooms, and there's a good chunk spent at that lovely beach cottage. I mean, I think about 45 minutes spent just there, but the movie really does go, you know, does move across the world. And one of the first things I said about it was handsomely mounted, but it really, when the romance was my interest dipped on the emotional screen, I still was absolutely compelled by all the costuming and all of the sets. And then especially when he goes more international in the later, the last hour, you know, all that stuff was very well realized and expensive. You know, you can kind of see how it cost. I think Gomo Wikipedia, it cost $30 million. So that's, you know, for the time, that's expensive. That's an expensive film.
Look at the Oscar nominations for this recent, nominated for costume design, art direction, editing, sound, and screenplay. This is down in the craft side, and one for cinematography. So the Oscars broadly agree. This movie looks good. I mean, and Beatty obviously wins for director.
Of course, it does
give you a sense of like what you lose in, you know, the simplicity of CG being like, oh, we'll just, you know, we'll drop a crowd in here, versus like the ability to either fill a room with extras or to really focus in on like a group of arguing people in a kind of claustrophobic dark environment where the people around them are just suggested.
Oh, I fucking loved it. Any time this movie brought them into a room of people who were shouting at each other.
Yeah, it was great.
My favorite bit is give me more.
when they get kicked out of the the socialist union, so they're starting, there are two halves of the left.
That scene's great.
And it's you really like funny. You get, they were kicked out for being too commie, and then that group is also organizing into how communists do want to be. Reed is on the ultra puritanical, like, you know, splitter side. It's just very funny.
It definitely has it's Life of Brian, isn't it? With the two,
I literally said that. Yeah,
yeah. But I love the juxtaposition in the movie, because it transitions between these two phases so quickly. Like, he's actually in Russia for the revolution. Those scenes go by quite quickly.
Go by really quick, yeah.
And then you're...
I thought that's what the whole thing was going to be about, to be honest. And that was maybe 10 minutes, yeah.
And then you're back, and very quickly it's... And he's written his book, and he's a big deal, and now he's getting more involved in the political side. Yeah. And I just thought the juxtaposition of, like, you go, like, here was a dude who went to Russia and played a part in this, you know, this 300-year-old dynasty being overthrown, and, you know, the people have overthrown the government, and a new political system taking over in Eastern Europe. And then he goes back to America, and... the bureaucracy within a fringe political party, and then the two offshoots that they tie, and you're like, so he went to Russia and overthrew the government, and he's come home,
he can't overthrow his own party.
Yeah, and then how all of that stuff is kind of like, you know, his ultimate downfall. Like, he doesn't want to still be in Russia.
They won't let him back because of sedition. Yeah,
Well, they won't let him back to begin with. Or, well, they were, you know, first of all, the Russians won't let him leave.
Yeah, the Russians won't let him leave.
The Americans won't let him come back.
And then he gets him in jail. Yeah.
thrown in a Finnish prison. all of the stuff that happens in the second half of the movie basically is a result of him being unable to get on with Paul Sorvino. And then the two of them bump back into each other again later.
Please help me.
Yeah, we're back on the same side again. Shit.
Yeah, they do spend a lot of the movie shouting about caucuses, and I could have done with 10 minutes less of that. Probably.
Oh, more? No, 10 minutes more.
Yeah, I loved that. Right. Loved it, yeah.
Just talking about that last chunk, and then I feel like we're wrapping things up with this. But and maybe in general, because the relationship just didn't work as much for me as it did for you, Joe, and James, I think. For me, the final hug, which is like the poster image, and it was the image that I think it's the image of the film. It's the two of them hugging at the train station. That just really didn't do for me what the movie wanted it to do, you know, mostly because the characters hadn't been with each other for, you know, maybe half an hour at that point, or 20-25 minutes, and I'd almost lost track of where they even were in their marriage.
But that's because you were in June Part Two in between that. I don't think the sequence of events at the end of the movie is that confusing to follow.
No, I thought it was pretty clear.
Yeah, so we'll blame the sandworms for that.
No, but it's not about confusing, just about length of time spent. I knew why it was happening, but it was that it had been a while since the two characters had been with each other.
I agree that I don't think that moment and the actual ending itself is completely successful, and mostly because, you know, I didn't know how this movie was going to end. I didn't know he was going to die. I assumed he was going to die. But they do that kind of, she's looking for him on the train, and you're like, is that his body bag? Mm. Turn around. Oh no, he's there. They hug. They're reunited. And then
he died.
and then we go to a hospital and he dies. And I'm like, okay. I like that relationship, and I'm glad that there is this degree of resolution between them. But I agree that I don't think that those final sequences work as well as the movie wants them to.
James, what do you think of the ending?
I thought the actual sequence of her looking for him on the train, I thought was really good, just because you spent so long of those two like completely out of contact, desperately trying to get in touch with each other and not knowing if the other is even alive. I agree that after that, you're just a bit like, okay, and then he passes out and is in hospital and dies. And you're like, shouldn't they have talked things over? Shouldn't they have had resolution? But instead, it's just, we're done. Like, I didn't even know if she was going to be allowed to leave Russia at the time, or whether she was going to be stuck there. You know, having thrown her life away.
That's a really good point, right?
It just shows you that Beatty just didn't care that much about Louise's story, because there's so much many machinations of getting there and trouble leaving, and then at the end, where do we leave the characters? So one of them is dead, and Louise, just in Russia. I don't know. Maybe she's fine.
I know from Wikipedia that she did. She just left.
Well,
and, you know,
my friend, Wikipedia was simply not around in 1981. So
I mean, neither were mobile phones. Neither were mobile phones. Otherwise, this film would have been a lot shorter.
I
think the emotional resolution of that relationship is simply the characters meeting. Right? It's the fact that she knows that he has been trying to get back to her, and he now knows that she's been trying to get to him the whole time. And because they leave things on an argument, right? She doesn't want him to go back to Russia. And for all he knows, right, it's like when she left the first time, that if he hadn't turned back up, the relationship probably would have never continued. So I think the actual, the moment and the kind of the embrace is the resolution. I don't know that you even need the stuff after. you know, it could have been even been a title card that, you know, John Reed passed away.
John Reed passed away the next day.
Yeah, shortly after this, and
20 hours later,
never returned to the US. Yeah.
Louise maybe made it back to Russia, though we haven't checked.
in a way, maybe that's like more powerful because it leaves more to the imagination than, you know.
Yeah, Warren Beatty.
She runs off and looking for a glass of water, and when she gets back, he's dead. Like. I don't know, it seemed like such an anticlimax in a way that didn't dramatize anything that I wanted to see. Like if they'd literally said, you know, he died in Russia having never returned to the US, and, you know, she went home alone. That almost you imagine better than we saw.
Not just died in Russia, never returned to America. He's the only, I think I read this somewhere, he was buried in the Kremlin and is the only American to do that.
I think there were three now. I think I read there were three.
Ah.
He was the first, certainly.
Here's the thing, I'm just on the Wikipedia. Here's something that I didn't know. Beatty and Keaton were together during the making of this. Interesting.
I'm not surprised by that.
No.
Because Warren Beatty. I think they've got chemistry.
Also, one thing I didn't know is music by Stephen Sondheim, which is kind of interesting.
Yes, that flashed up at the start.
Also worth mentioning, because we mentioned him earlier, and then we talked about Reds, and we haven't mentioned Gene Hackman is in this in like a scene.
two scenes, and he's good. He's good. He's particularly good in the second scene where he's drunk and running his mouth.
He's drunk. That's funny scene.
And one of the all time greats.
Yeah, definitely. Edward Herman. It's actually plays quite a major role. I know him solely from the Gilmore Girls. He's the granddad in that.
He is one of those character actors who just. Every time he shows up in something, he's good. And he can play like a real, like, stick up his ass kind of like comedy antagonist, and can also just be like this really, you know, the Gilmore Girls kind of character, which is this kind of, like.
Slightly bumbling.
It's like bumbling rich guy with a heart of gold, right? But yeah, he had a very lengthy character actor career in Hollywood, and he's just one of those guys that every time he turns up in something, he is great value.
I'm just again scanning Wikipedia if there's anything interesting worth sharing there. I'm not sure that there is. Actually, I mean, there's loads, but I can't just read it. Listeners, if you're interested, read the Wikipedia. There's some other interesting stuff there about, for instance, the Italian cinematographer could not shoot scenes in the US because he couldn't get a visa. Because local unions blocked him from doing work on the film. Anyway, that's not...
You're right, unions are bad. Unions are bad.
Unions are bad.
That is my takeaway from Reds.
thank you all for joining us for this Reds cast. I don't know if anyone has any final thoughts on Reds.
I think we've done it. I think we said it.
We've done Reds. Okay, wonderful. So thank you, listeners. My final thought on Reds is that... if you like Oppenheimer and you fancy another long auteur steered project about communism, which Oppenheimer is definitely about, maybe not mostly, but lots of it is about that, then check out Reds. It's interesting. And Diane Keaton and particularly Jan Nicholson are really good in the movie. Check out Reds. But that's it for this episode. Do we know what we are talking about for our next episode?
We are going to drop in a recording from our upcoming guest now.
Hello, Cinematic Universe listeners. This is Caroline Sita, and I had the pleasure and, frankly, the pressure of choosing any movie I wanted to talk about in the next podcast. And what I decided after a lot of deliberation is the 2021 Netflix film Tick, Tick, Boom, which, yes, is a musical, but also stars with Spider-Man. So hopefully there's something for everyone in there, and I can't wait to discuss it.
Oh my God, I'm really looking forward to discussing that film. I haven't seen it in yonks, if I've even seen it, so I'm really, really thrilled to discuss it, and that'll be out in a few weeks with a wonderful guest that you just had. But that's it for today's show. Thank you for listening. I've been Reese. Goodbye, podcast.
Goodbye, podcast.
Goodbye, podcast.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.